This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is Earth designed for life? Is this a casino of chance where catastrophe decides the survivors? We dive in with this timely replay interview with climate extinction expert Dr. Peter Ward. A new study finds 41,000 Americans die each year due to wildfire smoke. That number almost doubles by 2050, with economic losses greater than any other threat from warming. Details coming up. The new Global Tipping Points Report 2025 is just breaking. We prepare with last year's chat with lead author Dr. Tim Lenton, University of Exeter, UK. I'm Alex Smith. Deep past, near future. Fill your mind with Radio EcoShock. Is Earth designed by life for life? Or is this a casino of chance where catastrophe decides who survives? Those questions and more this week with Dr. Peter Ward on Radio EcoShock. I can tell you Peter is a professor at the University of Washington. He's a paleontologist. He's a specialist in the long history of Earth, its climate, and its periods of mass extinction. In my opinion, Peter is also one of the most underestimated minds in American science. I know he'll blush when I say that, but his 11th book shook me. It's called Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, the Mass Extinctions of the Past, and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future. That book presents the best theory we have on the mechanism of great mass extinction. And that was in 2007. 2 years later, he surprises again with the Medea hypothesis, which we'll touch on. And his 2010 book, The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, stands near my desk as a standard for the public. And in 2015, he published A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth with Joel Kirschfink. It's radical science. We'll find out why. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, you're right. I am blushing.
Okay, well, I've saved up some serious questions for you over the past few months, which touch on your string of books. And I'd like to begin by revisiting your now 10-year-old theory of how a massive extinction on land and sea creatures happened. Please describe the organisms that created a poisonous atmosphere for a time on Earth.
Well, they say that the meek shall inherit the earth, and I think maybe that is just our underestimation of bacteria as being meek. They certainly run this world in terms of elemental cycling. They run the world in so many different ways, but I guess if whenever you say don't make Mother Earth really mad, you're really saying don't enrage the bacteria. It's the microbial world which has gathered together to put forward some really nasty characters that, in sum, have been able to produce these global catastrophes.
And you've dived into a lake that had that kind of what I would call anti-ecology, for us at least. What was that like?
Well, there are several of these, actually. The one that I know best is in Palau. It's a series of actually small lakes where on the surface you have these fantastic and marvelous jellyfish, but down beneath we find a completely different group of organisms. They're microbial, they're scummy, greenish in color, and you're diving down through crystal clear down into this green goo, and you're also diving down from really the metaphor for our modern world, one full of animals, down into a world that was that before animals, the Precambrian world. And these, of all the microbes, are, at least for we animals, the most devastating because they produce hydrogen sulfide, very toxic, that nasty smell from rotten eggs, which is hugely poisonous to us. It's produced through normal respiration by these microbes, and it does move upward into the other parts of the lake, so the whole place smells like rotten eggs, at least faintly.
And do we know where these sulfur-based organisms came from? Were they here on Earth before the great oxygenation event, or could they have arrived from outer space?
Well, we certainly know they're among the most ancient organisms on Earth. And any one of us, I know you are located in British Columbia, it's not very hard to go find some. Simply go to a beach, dig down through the sand, even for 6 or 10 inches, and you'll hit this black, gooey layer, and you can smell the noxious sulfur coming out of it. The fossil record of these is very poor, but we have a microbial record that we can use from actually what makes oil called biomarkers. And we find this oily residue all the way back in rocks over 3 billion years in age. And in fact, some people now believe that these sulfur-producing organisms were at least very close to what the very first organisms on Earth were. Now, whether they came from meteorite from space or whether they originated here on Earth, you can make arguments either way.
So they're lurking, just waiting for the right conditions. And what are those conditions?
Well, they're strange organisms in that they really thrive in places where there is no oxygen. So this is where we find them on these beach locales. The top 10 or 15 or however many inches of sediment where you find hanging out the clams and worms and all the stuff we're used to, you go down deeper very quickly. If it's a thick, muddy sand, no oxygen can diffuse down into it. And so you find this oxygen-free environment, and that's where these things do best. They cannot live in free oxygen, but they certainly can live in places with very little oxygen, and they do, and they thrive.
All right. Now, on that note, a few weeks ago, I interviewed the Russian scientist Sergei Petrovsky, who's now working in the UK, and his work suggests that phytoplankton, which produce the majority of the world's oxygen, could thrive as warming progresses up to a point. And then many species could go into extinction. There is a tipping point there, he says. And the paper is called Mathematical Modeling of Plankton, Oxygen Dynamics Under Climate Change. Now, if that's true, would that relate to your theory of deadly changes in ocean life?
Well, absolutely. What the really lethal limit for the phytoplankton will be, there's a couple things. One would be there's not enough carbon dioxide. Well, we certainly know that's not the case. But secondly, it's temperature. What happens for many of these phytoplankton actually have to have oxygen. We know that the warmer the water is, the less oxygen it can take up. It holds less oxygen. Cold water has lots of oxygen. Warm water doesn't. If we keep warm in the oceans, we lose oxygen out of them. We finally get to a point where there's no oxygen, and you're killing off the vast majority of phytoplankton, which themselves actually thrive in oxygen conditions.
Sergei Petrovsky told us he had not yet checked his model against the paleoclimate record. Peter Ward, are you aware of any dip in world oxygen levels in that record since the great oxygenation event 2.3 billion years ago? Has it happened?
Oh, yes, it's happened multiple times. Each of the great mass extinctions, in fact, of the last 500 million years has been proximately caused by a reduction in oxygen. And we find these conditions which cause oxygen to go down are themselves related to enormous changes in the geological history of the planet. If you have a case where you are suddenly exposing, let's say, lots of minerals that are already reduced, in other words, they haven't been turned to rust. So let's say we have lots of iron before we put it in oxygen and let any water go near it. Expose lots of iron-rich sediment that is in that chemical state, and you draw oxygen right out of the atmosphere. The history of the Earth showed this early on. We have huge deposits of what are called banded iron deposits, and in fact, the richest iron deposits that we find around Lake Superior and much of Canada were deposited over a billion years ago in conditions with very low oxygen. So we know that this has periodically happened. In the last 500 million years, the lowest that oxygen got was about 10%. It's 21% now. So it hasn't gone down to zero in the last at least 600 or 700 million years.
Okay, I'd like to move on to a question that touches on your book, The Flooded Earth. In Robert Scribler's blog, he's just a blog that I love to read, Robert Marston Fanny says sea level rise has accelerated, quote, from 2009 through October 2015, global oceans have risen by 5 millimeters per year. And he cites data in a graph from Aviso, A-V-I-S-O, the satellite altimetry data site. But on the other hand, Peter, a very new science has come out suggesting a drier state of land is soaking up more moisture than before, limiting sea level rise. And that comes from work by J.T. Rager, a researcher with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So we have two different points of view here. Peter, what do you see happening in this matter of short-term sea level rise?
Well, there's far more than two. I think you're probably going to have a point of view from virtually every scientist who looks out there. I mean, the nice thing about those two examples is they're both really interesting examples of, first, how good our equipment is. Can you imagine that you're able to measure through satellite technology such a tiny change in sea level? But secondly, the other aspect that the land is drier, I don't think many people have really touched on that in the past. It's just one more example of how complicated it is to arrive at conclusions. I personally would be very much afraid of trying to make any sort of conclusion on a five-year record. Sea level rise is so slow. And the bigger problem with sea level rise is it happens at different rates in different places. The West Coast of North America has a much different sea level rise than, say, the East Coast of North America does, and a difference, again, from the Gulf of Mexico, and very much different from the Indo-Pacific. So it's complicated.
And we found this with temperature. It isn't so much the global mean that matters. It's what happens where you are in the different regions and different countries. I guess the same is true of sea level, just the way you describe it.
Yep. They say that all politics is local. Well, so is all environmental change. Really, you go back to ever smaller areas, and certainly the sea level rise conundrum is facing different countries with different aspects of the equation. In the long run, and by the long run, I mean certainly over the next century, everybody is going to be affected by it, and there's no going back. It's certainly not going to start going down again. But the question about rates is just that, which we touched upon, that we need longer periods of observation to really understand the trends. And the other thing is there's always seemingly some brand new bit of data, just like that dry and land aspect, that perhaps slightly changes things. It's the long scale picture, and here is our biggest problem, because no politician is going to think in 50-year intervals. And when we start thinking about what is going to be the future of the human race over the next centuries, trying to get anyone to think about this. One of the great tragedies of recent history, I think, is going to go down is this recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling. This is a disaster. I mean, this will be, I think, marked in history in the future as one of the great disasters.
Can you tell our overseas listeners what that ruling was?
Yes, the United States, after a huge amount of negotiation back and forth, and one of the really brave acts of the Obama administration, worked out a deal with China, and these, as the two biggest emitters of carbon dioxide, made an actual agreement that would slow the rise of greenhouse gases. We're not saying anything about stopping it. We're just trying to slow the rise. But even that was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, and what was so surprising about that ruling is that the normal business of the U.S. Supreme Court is to make rulings when lower courts have made a decision. But this was a highly politicized move by the Republican-led faction of the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a 5-4 decision, and they made this ruling even before lower courts had decided upon it. This is such a slap in the face. It is also a signal that the full court would definitely remove these particular conditions. Now, the wild card, of course, is the death of the most conservative of the Supreme Court justices, Scalia. But this, in a way, will make things even worse, because now we're going to have 4-4 votes in all probability, and when there is a 4-4 vote, the prior rulings are just left in place.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. My guest from the West Coast is Dr. Peter Ward, scientist, author, and expert in past extinctions. He's from the University of Washington. Moving on, starting in the 1700s, as you know very well, scientists, especially geologists, described the world as a gradual continuum where the present is the key to the past. The opposite theory, called catastrophism, was left for fringe writers like Immanuel Velikovsky, maybe. But where does your new book, A New History of Life, fit in?
Well, I guess that makes me a fringe writer. Darn it. I was always suspicious of that. It's interesting. Another so-called fringe writer was a man named Lamarck, who was an evolutionist way back during the French Revolution. And just as we are starting to see revolutionary new ideas about geology, so too we're beginning to understand some very revolutionary new ideas about evolution that themselves interact very much so with this whole idea of catastrophism. I personally think that what we call uniformitarianism. And there's a word that will make you a lot of money in a Scrabble tournament. Uniformitarianism suggests that to understand anything of the past, you have to invoke modern-day processes. But I was just thinking about these past mass extinctions. Let's think about a world where the surface of the oceans is filled with these tiny microbes that produce hydrogen sulfide. There is no ocean on the planet that shows that. I mean, the closest thing we have is the Black Sea, and yet even there, we still have a pretty thick oxygen layer up on top, enough for fish. Well, trying to invoke uniformitarianism to understand these times of very low oxygen surface oceans just can't be done. Trying to understand what happens after a giant meteor impact, the effect it has on climate, that just can't be done. There are case after case after case where you just cannot use the modern to understand the past. And unfortunately, there are case after case where I think we won't be able to use the modern to understand future history as well.
And I presume this new book also originates from your earlier work, The Medea Hypothesis. Talk to us about your ongoing argument with James Lovelock and the Gaia Hypothesis.
Well, much of that comes, again, from this idea about uniformitarianism, but the Gaia Hypothesis comes in several forms. It goes from what they call extreme Gaia, where the most extreme Gaia Hypothesis or theory, as Lovelock says, is that the Earth itself is a superorganism and is alive. Going back down the scale, much of what the Gaia Hypothesis research did, though, was very good. We began to understand a great deal about carbon cycling. We know much more about how nitrogen and other elements move through systems, and much of that was really stimulated by Lovelock and other ideas. Lovelock was trying to understand how atmospheres respond to the presence of life. But the scary thing to me about Gaia was this idea that life would fix it, that we can break the atmosphere by chemically changing it, and that life would find a way, as they said in Jurassic Park, old Dr. Malcolm, to bring it back into an equilibrium that's better for life. I really don't think that's the case.
And how does your new history of life, what does it say about Darwin and the theory of evolution as the primary narrative of life's development on Earth?
Well, one of the real interesting and, to me, in a way, scary aspects of biological research has been the research into a field called epigenetics, not just plain genetics, as Mendel first originated, but epigenetics suggests that something entirely non-Darwinian. Darwin, as we know, said that the way that organisms evolve is that you have natural selection, that an organism will produce more offspring, a species will produce more individuals than its environment can hold. There's just too many, and some will die. But Darwin never thought that any change that could happen in your life, other than your own death, would affect evolution. What if, for instance, something in your life completely changed your genes, so that if that event had not happened, you would have children that are different than they otherwise were? Well, this is what epigenetics is suggesting, that there are subtle and sometimes not so subtle changes to our sperm and our eggs that are produced by events in our lifetime. Darwin rolls over in his grave over and over and over every time a new research topic in this comes out, and increasingly it's being shown that this is the case.
So how would you describe this book for us?
Anytime you try to tell yourself that something is new, pretty much you'll find out from your audience that no, it's not new. Someone already found it out a long time ago. And there's the hubris in trying to say that you're trying to do something differently. Luckily or happily, some of the predictions that we've made and I've made in the past are coming true, but most unhappily for me, others of them are really coming true. In 1994, I published a book that was called The End of Evolution, and certainly this epigenetics is suggesting that evolution is changing. It's certainly not the end. That wasn't my title, that was the publisher's. But the prediction back in 1994 that we would see a drastic decrease in overall biodiversity has certainly been held up in the recent book, The Sixth Extinction, is just a replaying of that 94 book of mine over and over, and it's unfortunately the case. So what we try to do in this new book is to marshal, based on the newest scientific discoveries, ideas about the origin of life, about how early life was challenged by changing atmosphere, trying to look at what lower and higher oxygen meant during the period when animals first appeared, and trying to give some predictions then both about the future, but also pointing out the greatest dangers affecting the biosphere and how atmospheric change, much as like we're seeing now, are themselves a terrible, terrible portent.
I want to talk to you about something rather strange about Google and the way the web tends to warp things. You know, when I talk with some of the world's top scientists, and I do, it's not uncommon for them to mention your theories. And Radio EcoShock listeners ask about you. You've been on PBS, Coast to Coast AM, you helped Animal Planet. But if I Google Peter Ward and climate, the top couple of pages refer to a man who really is on the fringe of climate science. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Absolutely. There's a funny story. He's pretty unhappy with me. And we, at the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America, the other Peter Ward, who certainly doesn't hold views that I subscribe to, had a talk, and he was given one of the prime slots, and the room filled up, and he stood up, and then people were saying, wait a minute, that's not Peter Ward. And others of my friends were going, my God, Peter, you've gone mad. Why are you espousing this crazy idea? What is wrong with you? We have to use our middle names. Mine's D. I think his is J. Yeah, we run into each other, and it used to be sort of funny, but he doesn't see the humor in it anymore. He seems rather angry, as a matter of fact.
Well, listeners, Dr. Peter Langdon Ward is a volcano expert, and he brings out the theory that volcanic eruptions and depletion of ozone and chlorinated substances cause global warming and not fossil fuels. So, yeah, definitely a fringe case. Do you think, Peter Ward, the real Peter Ward, that human greenhouse gas emissions have stopped the next scheduled ice age from happening?
I really suspect so, and I think most climate scientists are also in that point of view. Just, we really understand that. It still amazes me how such a small change in a number of molecules in air can have such a world-changing effect. I mean, we're talking about hundreds to thousands of molecules among the untold billions. When you're talking about parts per million or parts per thousand and the slight changes that can cause atmospheric carbon dioxide change to produce huge, huge climate effects, it's so surprising to me how unbelievably powerful carbon dioxide is, and even more so methane. This is why this leak that I'm surprised has not gotten more press, this gigantic methane leak that has been taking place in California for months, has received so little press play, really. And yet this is a catastrophe of great, great size.
Wow, I agree with you. Okay, now, if life bumbles along through these long periods between catastrophes, and the catastrophes may be of life's own making, where do you think we are now? Are we on the edge of a next mass extinction, or could that be thousands of years from now?
Well, I think you hit the right idea that I think life in some ways is like the redoubtable British. You know, they're going to bumble right through it and get through it. We are producing huge negative effects, but at the same time, there are so many people, and I will take the moment to make you blush, such as yourself, who are doing so much to make things better, that through science and through education and through just a change in consciousness, people are changing the way they live, that we are reducing our footprint. Both are happening at the same time. There are more and more humans, obviously, and this is causing great changes on the planet. And yet the rate at which people are understanding the negativity that we can do in large numbers, I think, is also helping things get better.
Okay, for me, one of the huge questions is, knowing what we know, is whether global warming is reversible. If we could find a technology or change civilization so that we reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, maybe even get to those pre-industrial levels of 280 parts per million, could the coming catastrophe be averted, or is it already in unstoppable play?
Well, some parts are unstoppable, some aren't. Let's pretend that we just shut down all greenhouse gases right now. I mean, obviously, volcanoes are going to still do what volcanoes do, but let's go pre-industrial. As you know, we have lots of things that will take up carbon dioxide, and certainly the oceans have been really saving the collective human butt, if I can use that word, for some time now, because ocean is able to absorb so much of the carbon dioxide we produce. But we've already built into the sea level system, I believe it's from a half meter to as much as a meter of sea level rise that is in place, that whether we put another CO2 molecule in the atmosphere or not is still going to happen. We're still going to get that 1 meter rise. And there's nobody, no one who thinks that we're going to be able to shut it all down. We can't shut down human population growth. We are what? We're heading towards 7 billion very quickly. And the best hope is we only hit 9 billion. But there are a lot of people who still think we'll hit 11 billion. Even if we have entirely renewable resources, that many people is going to produce a huge footprint on this planet. So it's a race, really. It's a race between this population growth and the scientific and engineering, and if I dare say, the social fabric of our planet, where we get enough people in enough powerful enough positions to make the changes that are necessary. And then I go back once again to this most unfortunate U.S. Supreme Court decision. Because if the U.S. backs out of even the pitiful amount of climate change understanding that this one accord was to put forward, why would India and China, which are the two other giant players, or even Europe as a whole, why would they go ahead and try to match U.S. goals here? So that, to me, this is, again, a watershed moment in not U.S. history, that too, but in global history.
You know, I feel a sense of schizophrenia. Along with you, I see the signs that we are ruining the climate, that we need to live. But in the meantime, life can be lots of fun. I get up and do what most people do. How do you deal with that dichotomy?
There are good days and bad days, just like anybody else. And I think the best one can do is say, I don't have a magic wand, but I certainly have a footprint. And I just try to keep my footprint as small as I can. I have to tell myself to quit lecturing because I can be a scold, and nobody likes to be a scold. I think the world can have many scolds as long as they hold out some hope. It's scolding without recourse to hope that I think is even a greater disaster.
And as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to talk to us about? Maybe your current research or science that excites you, anything?
Well, the one thing I've been trying to do on small scales is, this is not saving the world, but it's trying to save one species. I began my work with the chambered nautilus, and I have been, over these last 5 years, been going out over and over and over again. There was an interesting news article on my work last summer called Rare Nautilus Seen After 30 Years. The sad, scary thing to me is that where that very strange, different nautilus, one that I named, in matter of fact, is called Allonautilus, the other nautilus, is found around the eastern side of Papua New Guinea, a place called Manus Island. And coincidentally, that area is about to be mined for the first time in enormous fashion by a Canadian company called Nautilus Minerals. How's that for irony? They're going to go down and grab up entire metalliferous hydrothermal vents from deep water. They have put out what I think is a ridiculous environmental statement saying that they will have no effect on the very fragile ecosystems out there. And they, frankly, just do not really seem to want to be criticized. So what got me going, two teenage kids, and then when they were grade school kids, started a website and a fundraiser called SaveTheNautilus.com. And what they're doing with that money is they have been funding researchers to go out and look at the chambered nautilus and try to understand, should it get more protections? Now, they funded part of my trips, but others as well. And these are kids that are taking a dollar at a time from their friends and putting together little bits of money. But it's that sort of mentality. Let's go out and do what we can. And so they've inspired me to try to make a case for international protection of not just the nautilus, that beautiful seashell, but lots of other invertebrates that don't get the press that the rhinos and the lions and tigers do. So SaveTheNautilus.com, two kids trying to make a difference. It's a website. It's very inspiring.
Okay, we've been speaking with Dr. Peter Ward. He's a paleontologist, professor at the University of Washington, author of more than a dozen books. His latest book is A New History of Life, The Radical New Discoveries About the Origins and Evolution of Life on Earth. I can't think of a more important topic. You can find my previous interviews with Peter and all sorts of follow-up links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, thank you so much for joining us again.
As always, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Last August, as wildfire smoke filled many a sky in the Northern Hemisphere, I came back from vacation to produce a new show, Hazards of Wildfire Smoke. New science revealed what is in that smoke, from heavy metals to exotic chemicals, leading to brain damage and early death. It turns out wildfire smoke is up to 3 times more dangerous than common industrial smog. I listed out 9 reasons why you need to know, including severe carbon loading in the atmosphere from all those evaporating forests. Wildfire smoke is a double emergency for health and climate change. Here's what journalist Liz Kimbrough writes at Monga Bay. A new Nature study projects wildfire smoke will cause 71,000 excess deaths annually in the U.S. by 2050. Representing $608 billion in damages that exceed all other estimated climate costs combined. Researchers linked climate conditions to fire emissions, smoke concentrations, and mortality using historical death records and satellite data, finding that approximately 41,000 annual deaths already occur from wildfire smoke, end quote from Monga Bay. This new study, led by Chinese authors, looks at the United States because that is where good data can be found, well, at least before the current administration. But bodies are bodies. Think of all the wildfires in Greece, Spain, and France this year. Wildfires are increasing across Russia, as you know. Australia has bushfire worry years and bushfire horror years. Indonesia regularly burns. Everybody needs to learn from this U.S. example. Here is a key fact. Wildfire smoke is loaded with tiny particles, technically called PM2.5 or less. That means less than 2.5 micrometers in diameter. A single strand of human hair is typically around 50 to 70 micrometers. That means PM2.5 particles are 20 to 28 times smaller than the average human hair. You can't see them. Neither can the body's inbuilt protection systems, like nose hairs and the blood barriers. These toxic particles, which can include heavy metals and noxious chemicals, go right into our fat cells, lungs, all the organs, even into our brains. Wildfire smoke can speed up or possibly trigger dementia. It is that serious.
Air is bad. Stay, I can't leave. Every day is a heavy load. With these hot and polluted episodes, take a long fall, take a gas. Hot and polluted to the last.
There are a lot of surprises in the new study titled Wildfire Smoke Exposure and Mortality Burden in the U.S. Under Climate Change. For example, people in the eastern United States are harmed even more than those living in the west, where more forests burn. Blame the wind. The authors also find, even when humans stop adding more carbon than nature can recycle, like net zero, the numbers of wildfire smoke deaths and damages will continue to increase. There are delays in natural systems that take decades or centuries to rebalance or repair. The effects of wildfires increasing during global warming will go on for generations. You can find links to the Monga Bay article and this new paper published in Nature October 8th in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Check out my August 13th, 2025 Radio EcoShock show, Hazards of Wildfire Smoke, for all the risks and some tips on what you can do to protect your own health.
Radio EcoShock.
A new science report just out, currently under embargo, says new reality as world reaches first climate tipping point. I'll cover the new Global Tipping Points Report 2025 soon. Let's get ready with this fall 2024 review of Tipping Point Science with the lead author, Tim Lenton, in the UK. Like living in the pressure cooker, super hot coil. Turn up the gas and burn that oil in the pressure cooker.
Perilous times on planet Earth.
That is the state of our climate right now in 2024. Who says so? A really impressive group led by Oregon's William Ripple and complete with climate science leaders like Johan Rockström, Michael Mann, Naomi Oreskes, Stefan Rahmstorf, and Thomas Crowther, among many others, all Radio EcoShock guests, by the way, talk us through the latest report in another big name in the field. It's Dr. Timothy Lenton. He is founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, chair in climate change and earth system science there, and a highly cited publishing scientist. From Exeter, UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be back.
We have been blown off the map of anything normal. How can scientists like your group help us to understand where we are?
Well, we're just trying to give a clear communication of the planet's vital signs. We do that by keeping track of a whole range of variables that are either the response of the climate itself to human activities or the human activities that are driving the climate change. And we're doing that year on year with this annual report. And once again, it's a shocking year, our assessment for the last 12 months.
And the state of the climate report starts off with a series of gut punches. The first sentence is, "We are on the brink of an irreversible climate disaster." I had to stop and think that one over. Things do seem bad, but is that going too far?
Well, if we're thinking about this as a risk management problem, no, we're just trying to say that it's a bit like you'd approach getting on an aeroplane, I suppose. You want to be pretty sure it's not going to fall out of the sky. But the problem with the climate is the last 12 months or so has shown us some really extraordinary hot temperatures, particularly the ocean surface temperatures are just way out of the range of recent variability. And we're fairly confident now that 2024 is going to be the first year globally on record that's been 1.5 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial average, or more than that. And unfortunately, the climate science community can't yet come up with a convincing explanation for why the temperatures have deviated from so high and for so long. So I would interpret these extraordinary, we would call it temperature anomaly, as a kind of clear sign that there's some destabilization that's going on or gone on in the climate. And of course, we're hoping the temperatures come back, but they're still on the overall rise, along with a bunch of the other metrics we highlight.
Yes, Earth just went through a natural warming from El Nino plus our human-made heating. Is it possible, Tim, we could see a cooler year or two, or is it just hotter every year from now on? Do we know?
Well, we would expect, with the sort of variability that we get, for example, the El Nino has officially ended and yet the temperatures have stayed high, but we would normally expect that there will be some fluctuations. So we can easily go from and let's hope we do go from the current extraordinary heat to a cooler year or two. This is just normal that you get these shorter-term fluctuations around a rising average, shall we say. What's crazy about the current fluctuation above the average is it's just staying there, and it's much larger than we've seen before. But yeah, we would, if we got a strong La Nina, as it's called, we would certainly expect to see some temporary cooling relative to this rising trend. But it's not arrived yet.
Another concern for me, there is not much wildlife out there left. I mean, wild mammals are about 4% of mammal biomass. The rest is all humans and our livestock. Is that a factor in this climate emergency?
Well, it is, particularly in the sense that the ruminant livestock, which is one of the indicators we track, not only are they at a record level, and we add something like 170,000 ruminant livestock to the global population every day, which seems extraordinary, doesn't it? Not only are they at a record level, but of course, ruminant livestock, they take an extraordinary amount of land. They're extremely inefficient, if you like, as a source of calories or protein. And they are an unusually strong source of methane emissions. And the land that they demand is in the global tropics, the single largest driver of tropical deforestation, which, of course, is itself a source of carbon dioxide being released from destroying the trees, essentially. And if we turn to the forest story, there's a little bit of good news that in the Brazilian Amazon, we saw in the last year a decline in the loss of the forest, although it still is being lost, just at a slower rate. But globally, over the last 12 months, we saw the global loss of tree cover really escalate, and that's partly not just because people were chopping forests down, but rather because there were really unprecedented massive areas of wildfires in the last year. And then that's also carbon that's adding to the atmosphere.
The United Nations process says 1.5 degrees C warming over pre-industrial is the line we should not cross, and I believe 190 countries agreed to that. According to your new report, a 2024 poll finds almost 80% of scientists responding expect heating by at least 2.5 degrees C, half, fully half, foresee a catastrophic 3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. Scientists know. Why doesn't the public?
The public, some of them also intuitively realize that things are heading way into the danger zone if we were to carry on with current policies. And that's why some of the public, at least, are joining us scientists in pushing our elected leaders to basically act more decisively in terms of specific policy actions that can accelerate the end of fossil fuel burning, the switch to cleaner, greener power, and so forth, tackling basically the key drivers of climate change.
And last March on Radio EcoShock, you gave us an update on tipping points. Something like slowing the North Atlantic current that keeps the UK weather moderate is huge. You just went through a kind of cool and wet period. It must be making people there nervous. It was bad for farming. But a lot of institutional publications and news media just leave tipping points out as if they don't exist. Tim Linton, what should we be telling ourselves about climate risks possibly bigger than the civilization can handle?
Well, we need to wise up to the fact that there's a significant risk of crossing climate tipping points that really would be a challenge for our societies, because they can fundamentally change the pattern of climate across the world. So suddenly what seemed like a nice habitable island with a huge number of people on it, like the UK or the UK islands, suddenly becomes a less good place to be if we cross a tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean's great overturning circulation. Now, the key thing in a risk assessment is to recognise that the thing you need to look at first is what's the worst thing that can happen and can I rule it out? And that's why I've been placing an emphasis on looking at these tipping point scenarios, because at the moment we definitely can't rule them out. And the more science we do, the more worrying it gets, because the more, rather than ruling them out, we start to see they look more likely than we thought they were. So, yeah, that's crucial information for all of us, but especially for governments, basically, who need to be putting the possibility of damaging climate tipping points into their risk thinking and their risk management. Because, of course, good governments they do have a process for thinking about risks, and that would include thinking about risks like another pandemic, like the COVID-19 pandemic, or thinking about terrorist risks, or thinking about a war, or yet another war escalating. But our argument, I think, would be pretty clear that these climate tipping point risks are, in some cases, quite a lot bigger if they were to come to pass than any of the other risks I just listed. So they definitely should be in our, you know, in our collective risk thinking, and certainly in our government's risk thinking.
Well, no doubt you have a comfortable home in England. Food in the grocery store is more expensive, but there is food. This new report, though, says we fear the danger of climate breakdown. Do you and other leading scientists believe that society itself could collapse if we get into a permanent state of climate emergency?
I think it's a definite risk. That's partly because when I and my group have looked at the climate model of passing, say, a key climate tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean circulation, combined with the 2.5 degrees of global warming that we should expect under current policies, and as you said, many climate scientists would expect later this century. When you combine those two things, the global warming and the tipping point, we can crop model and quickly discover that there are viable area for growing the major staple crops of, say, wheat and maize worldwide, reduced by more than a half. So that looks to me like a food security crisis, and it would be underlain by a kind of water security crisis. So that looks like a serious challenge to societies, and it would have many other ramifications as well. The whole pattern of climate would have changed. Of course, we might manage the situation by suddenly eating a lot less of those ruminant livestock, because they're using up a whole lot of agricultural land in the wild. It's hard not to conclude that it'll be extremely challenging to adapt to such a kind of climate shock that manifested as a food and water security shock, including in, you know, some of the richest and most populous nations, let alone for the less well-off people on the planet. Because we also see in that scenario there'd be major disruption of the Indian monsoon, so the a crisis in India and the West African monsoon, so a crisis in the Sahelian regions and countries like Nigeria, one of the most populous countries in the world.
Imagine the sacrifice required to really slash our emissions personally and as an economy. I suppose it is less than sacrificing lives in war, but only just. At the moment, there's not much social or political will to do it. And we've been told for a long time, well, the next 10 years, that's critical, and those 10 years have passed. Is there a point where it is genuinely too late?
Well, there could well be a point at which things become too late, in the sense of too late to avoid the kind of risks that are hard to manage. But I wanted to emphasize that it's not a sacrifice to switch from a fossil fuel-powered societies to renewable energy-powered societies. On the contrary, renewable power is now the cheapest form of electricity in most of the world. In fact, it now makes economic sense in the majority of the world to close existing fossil fuel power stations and replace them with new renewables and battery storage. So we are seeing what I call some positive tipping points to a new energy system. We certainly need policy makers and policy support and governments to get behind those and to realize those opportunities. And they're huge opportunities, because still worldwide, at least 5 million people die every year from fossil fuel air pollution. So, you know, you get multiple co-benefits from going to clean energy. We will also have to tackle our current trend towards eating more and more meat on average worldwide. You know, eating too much red meat can be extremely bad for your health. It's not actually good for you. So everything in moderation in that case. But there are co-health benefits. Healthier diets are much healthier for the planet.
But we seem to be moving in the wrong direction. I mean, BP, British Petroleum, have backed away from their climate goals. We have governments, whether they're liberal or conservative or whatever you want to call them, are approving new oil and gas drilling leases. Even in Australia, they're expanding coal mines. It's way too late for that kind of stuff. I just wonder, are you hopeful?
I'm pretty despairing when I see those things that you just mentioned, but I always try to remind myself of the bigger picture here, which is we are also seeing the exponential growth of renewable energy. accelerating all the time. The same thing with the electrification of mobility, including electric cars, bikes, etc. So it's kind of a race of tipping points. In my head, it's a race to push and bring forward those positive tipping points to accelerate the change we need. Now, versus in order to avoid the bad tipping points in the climate that we're otherwise going to cross. And you're quite right to highlight that what I would call the incumbents, the status quo, fossil fuel burning being part of it, and the meat lobby, they are fighting back hard. And alas, recently they would appear to be winning in some sense in terms of getting these crazy retrogressive movements from business and some governments. But things change quite, you know, they can fluctuate just as in the climate. They can change fast in society as well. So there are some other bigger forces going in the right direction. But yeah, we do look to be behaving very collectively stupidly at the moment. And we always pride ourselves for being a supposedly intelligent species, but there's really no evidence we are on this climate crisis, sadly.
I'm old enough to remember you, Michael, Johan, Naomi, and Stefan before climate became controversial and political. Even conservatives spoke of the need to address climate. Maggie Thatcher did. Then research scientists were called to be public speakers and media communicators. I've never seen Stefan Rahmstorf speaking in more forums and tweeting and communicating as much. You yourself, you're getting out, you're making presentations. It's a change from just researching and reporting to the authorities, well, we have climate problems.
Oh, yeah, because we're human beings after all, and we get to stare day in, day out at this extraordinary, shocking evidence of how the climate is changing and the harms it's causing to people. And you can't, on your conscience, not go out and try and alert the world, both to the risks we see unfolding right now, but also try and alert the world to the only viable remaining opportunities to get out of trouble, which is really we have to tip to different technologies and different behaviors, but they actually bring a bunch of benefits with them. But we obviously need our elected leaders to get on board with that change as well. So we've got to. So we're going out to tell the world what the trouble is and how the trouble is escalating, but also, well, what's the only viable ways left to get out of this trouble before it gets too bad for anybody to manage it.
Well, there are unlikely to be massive climate protests in Azerbaijan at the next COP, the COP climate meeting in November, coming right up. Do you see any signs there could be some changes there that will at least help the climate?
At the COP meeting, I'm not feeling too optimistic of fundamental shifts coming from that process. In terms of the climate movement, I would love to see it back on the streets even more strongly, because I think that just makes it visible for everybody that there is an issue. Even if you as a listener disagree with the tactics of the movement, I think the movement has and can play an essential role in just continually reminding us all about what's happening. And obviously, we do that as scientists in our own this slightly different way, but I really do think we need to get this up our mental agenda and in order to fuel the action we need, and of course get it on the political radar in a way that it sticks as a priority for our leaders to address for all of our benefits, frankly. I mean, there's so much to gain in embracing the transition now, especially to clean energy. So what are we waiting for? Well, as usual, it's vested interest in the status quo is what's holding things back.
Tim, we're going to have to wrap this up. What are you and your team working on next?
Well, I've been working on what are the most effective policies to bring forward what I call the positive tipping points in the power sector to renewable energy, in the electrification of cars and trucks, in electrifying the heating of our homes. And we've been able to show that mandates, so the policies that mandate the end of fossil fuel technologies, like you're not going to be able to sell a petrol or diesel car in our market after 2035, or no diesel trucks after 2040, or we're going to close all coal-burning power stations by 2035 in rich nations. Those policies are hugely effective at triggering, amplifying feedbacks that accelerate the change we need, that make the new clean technologies cheaper and better, faster. They're way more effective than carbon taxes that have been talked a lot about. And subsidies are also fairly effective, but mandates are even more effective. So I've really been trying to bring that message out with some real numbers showing, you know, how particular policies could really help us accelerate out of trouble. And on the flip side, me and my group, we're really trying our best to improve our early warning systems, early warning capability for the bad climate tipping points. And we're doing what we can to mine the data we've got available to look for the early warning signals that crucial bits of the climate are losing stability.
Listeners, find out where you do stand. Check out the 2024 State of the Climate Report, Perilous Times on Planet Earth. It is free, it's easy to understand, and full of facts that are a bit hard to hear. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest is co-author Dr. Timothy Lenton, founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. Tim Lenton, thank you for your valuable time and for your warning.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Next week, I'll be back with more news from the real world, where sea currents, winds, and bacteria rule this tiny planet. We humans are just on the guest list, for now. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to the future. To get you started, appetizers are on fire. Wash that down with you. Rain tonight. The main course is hot, very hot. We have displaced people huddled on the sand. We have the last deluxe tables on the damaged land. You have artificial views. Ocean comes to you. You get mental storms and broken norms to enrich the chosen few. Welcome to the future, where everything is new.